is Paul Weber, and I am honored to be joined by Dr. Michael Gardam for a teleclass lecture entitled Interferon Gamma Release Assays for the Diagnosis of Latent Tuberculosis Infection. Dr. Gardam is known to many around the world, particularly in Canada, where he is oft interviewed and quoted in the media on anything to do with infectious disease. Dr. Gardam is not only the medical director of the Tuberculosis Clinic at the University Health Network in Toronto, he is an associate professor at the University of Toronto and a national expert on pandemic disease. In fact, this teleclass lecture was sidelined a few months ago when Dr. Gardam was called to investigate a wide-ranging series of outbreaks in Ontario and Quebec. I'm pleased, Michael, that we could finally get together to do this teleclass. So welcome, and I'll invite you now to give your teleclass lecture, Interferon Gamma Release Assays for the Diagnosis of Latent Tuberculosis Infection. Dr. Michael Gardam.
Thank you very much. So what I'll do is I'll just keep saying next slide as I go through here. So on my second slide, I just want to point out that I am doing studies with one of the assays I'm going to be talking about, just so you know I'm being upfront about that. On my next slide, my outline, I'm just basically going to go through some of the background surrounding latent TB infection, talk a little bit about sensitivity and specificity of tests. I'll then get into the tuberculin skin test, and I need to do that because in the end, you have to compare new assays with something, and most of our comparison is with the tuberculin skin test. I'll then talk about the new assays, how they work. I'll talk a little bit about the literature and the limitations of the literature, and I want to point out right up front that I cannot give a detailed review of the literature on this subject because there are literally now new papers coming out daily. And what I want to do, rather than go through literally 80, 90, 100 papers in a half hour or 45-minute talk, what I want to do instead is just touch on some of the issues with these papers because each paper has the same limitation. Go through some of that so you get a sense that when you read these papers, you know kind of what they mean. And then I'll go through some clinical considerations at the end where how we've been talking about using these assays in Canada. So go on to the next slide. This is a figure from the Canadian Tuberculosis Standards, and essentially it just sort of shows what happens when somebody gets infected with tuberculosis. TB, as you know, is an airborne disease. You breathe it in when somebody coughs. It ends up in your lungs, and right off the bat, roughly 95% of people who get infected will go into what we call latent infection. Another 5% of those will at some point go on and get reactivation TB, but overall, roughly 90% of people who are infected with Mycobacterium tuberculosis will not develop disease, and so they have what we call latent infection. The organism's there, but it's not doing anything. The other 10% will, of course, go on to get active tuberculosis. Most of that risk is in the first couple years after you got infected. So I'll move on to the next slide where I talk about test sensitivity. So a sensitivity of a test is basically a measurement of the number of subjects with the disease that you're interested in who test positive divided by the total number of subjects with the disease. So the key thing about measuring sensitivity, and we'll go on to the next slide, is that you actually have to know that people have the disease. So typically, for example, let's say you have a new test to diagnose some particular illness, and you have a gold standard for diagnosing that illness. Let's say it is doing biopsy or something like that. You can compare your new test to the gold standard test, which would be biopsy, and get a sense of, you know, how well is this working. So in terms of tuberculosis, if you knew people had active TB, you could do your test against people with in a population of people with culture-proven active tuberculosis, to give you a sense of the sensitivity of that test in that particular population. So for example, we know the sensitivity of the tuberculin skin test for active TB is about 70%. So roughly 7 out of 10 people with active tuberculosis will have a positive skin test. Go on to the next slide. Now specificity is the number of subjects who do not have the disease who test negative with your new test divided by the total number of subjects who do not have the disease. The next slide. So in order to calculate specificity, you want to test a population that you know does not have the disease you're looking for. So for example, if we stick with tuberculosis, you would test people who have no risk factors for tuberculosis infection or disease. So for example, you could test young, healthy Canadian or American-born people with no TB risk factors, and you would get a sense from that what the specificity of that test is. So going on to the next slide, so when you want to compare tests, so you get a new test and you want to compare it to the gold standard, you need to have that gold standard, because at the end of the day, if your new test is positive and the gold standard is negative, you want to be convinced that it's your new test that's wrong, not the gold standard. The challenge we have with tuberculosis, especially latent TB infection, is there is no gold standard for latent TB infection. We use the tuberculin skin test as a surrogate, but we know it's not always accurate. And so that's the challenge. And all of the studies that I'm going to talk about and all the studies you're going to see in the literature all suffer from exactly the same challenge, is there's no gold standard. So when you get a positive or a negative result, you're not quite sure whether it's true or not. So I'll go on to the next slide. So I'm going to talk about tuberculin skin testing, and I'll move on to the next slide here. So purified protein derivative, aka PPD or aka tuberculin. Basically what this is in a nutshell is it's dead ground up tuberculosis. So the lab's growing up TB, it is killed, and then they're somewhat purifying a protein component from that dead tuberculosis. But you can see it's not a really pure mixture, because you have over 200 antigens in that PPD. So it's a mixture of different antigens, which are not all completely unique to Mycobacterium tuberculosis. So for example, there's antigens in there that are found in Mycobacterium bovis, in the BCG strain of M. bovis, in other environmental mycobacteria. So you can imagine right off the bat that if you're infected or exposed to some of these other things, you might get into some trouble where this test is not as specific as you would like it to be. It's giving you some false positives. Go on to the next slide. So unfortunately, it gets worse after that. So not only do you have a test where the reagent has over 200 antigens in it, but you also have a test where you're measuring the bump on someone's arm. And you can imagine measuring a bump is not perhaps the most accurate way to do things, but that's what we have. So for example, if you were to skin test a person and then have a couple different people read it, you can imagine that they're not all going to come up with exactly the same amount of induration. So one might say 10, one might say 9, one might say 13 millimeters. So there is a range of almost 3 millimeters between people. Also, if you have the same individual read a test and then come back and read it again, let's say you've got 50 people in a room, you skin test all of them, and then you have somebody read them, wait an hour later, mix up the people, bring back in the reader again and have them read them again, you'll see that there's again a sort of a 1 to 2 millimeter variation. And finally, there's biologic variation. So if I plant a TB skin test on your left arm and one on your right arm, they're not going to be exactly the same size. So you can see that there's up to a 6 millimeters between skin test readings, which could just be due to error. Which again, if somebody is really positive or completely negative, you feel very confident in your reading. But many people are kind of in that mushy in-between zone, and these factors come into play in terms of whether you call someone positive or negative. Finally, as I mentioned earlier, there all are false negatives in active disease. And one of the key problems with the TB skin test is it requires two visits, one to plant it and one to read it. And that test has to be read between 48 and 72 hours after it was planted. That's when it was validated for. So you can imagine there's some days of the week where it's very hard to plant TB skin tests because people aren't going to come back on the weekend to have them read. So that is a real challenge, even having them come back and paying for parking and things. It really can make life difficult in terms of trying to interpret these tests. If I go on to the next slide, talking about sensitivity and specificity. So the sensitivity for the TB skin test is sort of cited at 97% for latent TB infection in healthy individuals. And the question I always ask is, how do we know that? Because again, we're making an assumption that in people where we're very confident have latent TB infection, it's very good. But how do you know for sure if there's no gold standard? Now that's healthy individuals. If people are immunocompromised, we know for a fact that if somebody has HIV, that the lower their CD4 count goes, the more false negative results you seem to be getting from the TB skin test. And similar thing you might find, for example, in hemodialysis patients. So the more immunocompromised or the more screwed up your cellular immune system is, the more problems you have with this test. I've mentioned already sensitivity is 70% for active disease, and specificity can be influenced by other things such as BCG vaccination and other mycobacterial exposure, and I'll explain those two in a moment. So, what about BCG? Of course, the reality is that most of the people who we consider high enough risk to be TB skin testing in North America are often people who have had BCG because they had it in their home country before immigrating to North America. So this actually does come up this is a very frequent problem. So the trick is that if you had the BCG vaccine in your first year of life, it really should not play a role in you being positive as an adult. Your positivity typically wanes after 5 years, and so it really shouldn't be an issue. However, if you got the BCG vaccine when you were in primary school, as a teenager, or as an adult, you can certainly be positive as an adult. And it's really impossible diagnostically to tell whether the positive test is due to BCG or whether it's due to the real thing. You can't actually tell for most people. The other thing to point out, of course, is that most people have no idea when they got their BCG vaccine. Most of them don't know they had it. Even if you notice a scar on their arm and ask them when they got it, most people can't tell you. The ones that can are typically the people who may have gotten this when they were in university or entering nursing or medical school. So those are people where you think, aha, there's a good chance they may be positive because they had BCG as an adult. But those are also people who are healthcare workers who have a higher risk of being infected with TB. So you can see, you really start to get a sense here that interpretation of these tests takes a bit of work. You really have to think about it a fair bit to really come up with probably the best interpretation of someone's result. Key thing at the bottom of this slide is that if your induration is greater than 18 millimeters, it's quite unlikely to be due to BCG. That's not an absolute. There are some people where it's been suggested to have indurations greater than 20 millimeters, but by and large, 18 millimeters is kind of a pretty good cutoff. So if you look at the next slide, this is really what this is showing. Now, this is not this slide is not generated from real data, as far as I understand. But this is a great picture from Michael Eisman's book on tuberculosis. I believe it's a hypothetical population. If you look at Figure A, these are people who are infected with tuberculosis, and you can see, not surprising, some of them have a zero reaction on their TSD. But in general, the population is centered around 15 millimeters. Section B shows people who are infected with other mycobacteria. So that could be, for example, if they had the BCG vaccine or were exposed to Mycobacterium avium or something like that. It's sort of centered around 6 or 7 millimeters. And our challenge gets into when you've got people that are potentially exposed to atypical mycobacteria who are also infected with the real thing. And here you can see that, you know, your skin test positivity around 10, and it's kind of a wash. I mean, if you were really trying to figure out which was which, you can't tell. And so typically what we do in North America is we assume that it's real. So somebody with TB risk factors who had BCG, if they're positive, we assume it's the real thing, it's not due to BCG, and we consider them as being latently infected with TB. But we know that we could be overcalling people. Once you get above 18 millimeters, however, though, we start feeling quite confident that this is due to tuberculosis and not due to something else. So we'll go on to the next slide. So in summary, the TST is believed to perform well in healthy, non-BCG vaccinated individuals, which, as I mentioned, unfortunately does not describe most of the people that we want to do TB skin testing in. Certainly, North American trained and born healthcare workers who have not received BCG, that's a group that with this the TST performs well in. But in other individuals where they've had BCG, et cetera, it can be confusing depending how old they were when they got it. The other thing that we didn't talk about too much is that the decreased sensitivity in immunocompromised individuals can be quite substantial. So people with low CD4 counts, end-stage renal disease, chronic corticosteroid use, people with hematologic malignancies or transplant recipients, these people all have problems with their cellular immune system, which is the part of the immune system which causes a positive test in the first place. Ironically, these are also the individuals at highest risk for getting active TB if they are infected. So So the population that you really want to know if they're infected or not are also the population where your test starts to fail on you. So I'm going to move to the next slide where we're now going to, that's basically in a nutshell, that's the tuberculin skin test. It's been used throughout the world. It's been around for 100 years. We've got very good epidemiologic data on how well it works and what some of its limitations are. And now we're going to bring a new set of tests into the mix and try to figure out which test is better. So the interferon gamma-based test, this funky diagram here is trying to explain why interferon gamma. So I'll walk you through this. So if you look down at the bottom of this figure at part A, when somebody is infected with tuberculosis, their macrophage is essentially engulfing the bacteria. The bacteria have evolved to live within the macrophage, but by being there, their presence stimulates the macrophage to produce TNF-alpha. TNF-alpha then essentially stimulates the macrophage to go on and release other cytokines, which then basically bring into the area a number of lymphocytes that are there as part of the cellular immune system to try to help that macrophage kill off those bacteria. As those T-cells get activated, they release interferon gamma. So in a nutshell, if somebody has been exposed to tuberculosis before, when you re-expose them to TB, their T-cells should produce interferon gamma. So if we could develop an assay that measures interferon gamma, we should have a measurement of what's actually going on. This same process is what goes on when you have a positive TB skin test. It's just that instead of measuring interferon gamma production, you're measuring swelling in the area, which happens because these T cells have gotten activated. So move on to the next slide. So there's two tests that I'm going to talk about. One's the QuantiFERON Gold test, which is an ELISA, which is licensed in Canada and the US. And the other one is the T-SPOT TB, which is an ELISpot, licensed in Canada. The U.S. license is still pending, and the ELISpot's also licensed in the European Union. I'm going to explain the difference between an ELISA and an ELISpot in the next couple slides. So an ELISA is essentially, it's called an enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay. And what this is you have an enzyme that's linked to an antibody directed against the molecule of interest. So in this case, you've got an antibody which is directed against interferon gamma. Basically, in your tube where you're doing this test, you're adding antibody. The excess antibody is washed off and a substrate is added. An enzyme acts on the substrate and causes a color change. Okay? So basically, the enzyme is just there to show you that you've got antibody bound to whatever it is you are interested in. If that's the way you actually figure out whether the antigen is there or not. The other test is the ELISpot, which is a similar concept but does have some pretty important differences. In this one, instead of measuring a color change because you've got an enzyme there, you're actually counting individual positive cells. So in general, ELISpots are believed to be more sensitive than ELISAs because you're not just counting sort of cytokines that are sort of diluted in the fluid. You're actually measuring the individual cells themselves, so you can count the number of cells that are actually involved. So let me talk a little bit more about these assays. So both of these tests use TB-specific proteins. Now, they're relatively specific for TB, and they're found off the region of different segments of the Mycobacterium TB genome. One of them is a protein called ESAT6. The other one is another protein called CFP10. The newest version of the QuantiFERON test has a third antigen, which isn't on your slide, which is called TB7.7. So there are actually three antigens in the QuantiFERON test. There's two antigens in the T-SPOT TB test. But the concept is that they're quite specific to Mycobacterium tuberculosis. So what other things can these be found in? So for example, wild-type M. bovis has these proteins, but not BCG. And that's very important. That's the big thing here, that these assays should not react to prior vaccination from BCG. There are also other atypical mycobacteria like Marinum, Kansasii, etc., which are reasonably common in North America and which can also theoretically give you a positive test. So these antigens are more specific. They're more specific to TB than the tuberculin skin test antigen, but they're not perfect. The big difference is ESAT-6, CFP-10 do not react to BCG, whereas the tuberculin skin test antigen does. So let's make it a little bit more confusing here. These tests that I just talked about are actually the most recent generations. There have been earlier generations of these tests that have used different antigens under different conditions, and there's lots of papers on them. So if you were to go back and do a Medline search going back to, say, 1999 or the year 2000, you're going to find a whole bunch of papers talking about QuantiFERON tests, but they're not the same test that's currently on the market. And that's a real challenge. So in a sense, a lot of those early studies, while very useful for sort of helping to better tweak these tests and make them better tests overall, they're not relevant right now in terms of trying to interpret how well to use the current tests, because they're different tests using different antigens. So just a word of warning, this is one of those situations where you don't want to go back too early in your Medline searches, because you're going to start pulling out papers that aren't that relevant to what you're doing. So on the next slide, I've got a bit of a schematic here showing how these two tests work. So with the QuantiFERON gold in tube test, both of these tests, I should start off, are blood tests. So blood is drawn into a tube. In the case of the QuantiFERON gold in tube, there's an antigen right in that tube. So if your T cells have seen TB before, they will start to produce interferon gamma, and this tube is incubated to allow that interferon gamma production to occur. You basically spin the cells down, and you take off the plasma, the supernatant, and you add it to microtiter wells. You add the enzyme, and if you've got antibodies that are bound to interferon gamma, the enzyme is bound to the antibody, you're going to see a color change when you actually add the substrate. The T-spot TB ELISpot is done a bit differently. First of all, it's drawn into a different type of tube. It's a type of tube which allows you to separate out the cells from the rest of the plasma. And so you spin them, and then you actually count the cells. So in the QuantiFERON gold, you're just measuring, you know, supernatant. In the T-spot, you're counting the number of cells that you have. You can imagine it's a bit more labor-intensive. Those counted cells are then added to microtiter wells containing interferon gamma antibodies. You then add your antigens, you incubate, and then you measure interferon gamma production, because each cell that's producing interferon gamma actually develops a spot, and you can actually count the number of spots in the well. So they're done differently. Similar kinds of concepts. They're both measuring your cellular immune system if it's actually been exposed to TB or not before. Let's move on to the next slide. So a summary slide. Both of these use RD1 antigens. The T-spot TB requires white cell separation and counting. The QuantiFERON measures gamma interferon production in the supernatant. Theoretically, the T-spot TB should be more sensitive than the QuantiFERON purely because it's a different type of assay. There are some papers that have come out in the last 6 months that go along with that, but I think it's important to note the word theoretically here. We're not at the stage yet where we can say categorically one test is more sensitive than the other, but it is looking like we're starting to head in that direction. I'll move to the next slide. So the big question, how do you evaluate a test when there's no gold standard for latent TB? And the hint is you can't just simply compare it to the TST and assume the TST is always correct, because we know it's not. Nor can you just compare it to the TST and assume that your new assay is always correct, because it's not going to be. So you're left with a lot of questions when you end up with discordant results where the two tests are not agreeing with each other. So how do you sort of look at this? Well, typically what people do is they measure the correlation between the tuberculin skin test and the interferon gamma release assay with known conditions that have varying risks of actually being positive. So for example, active TB. That's one where you know categorically they've got the disease you're interested in, but it's active TB, it's not latent TB infection. Remember, we have other ways of diagnosing active TB, be it symptoms, cultures, etc. But at least with that one, you know they have the disease. An outbreak setting, you can imagine if you have people exposed to a person with active TB, the contacts of that person may be high-risk or low-risk contacts. So you could test the high-risk and the low-risk contacts and stratify them according to exposure and then look at the responses with the tuberculin skin test and the interferon gamma release assay to get a sense of which one's giving you numbers that make more sense. You could look at them in high-risk settings, people who've been BCG vaccinated, and you could add in other variables, such as if whether they're immunocompromised. But the trick is you can't truly measure sensitivity and specificity because, once again, there's no gold standard here to tell you whether you're right or not. Move on to the next slide. So this is from a Lancet paper from 2003, and this is just an example. And again, this is not meant to be an exhaustive literature review. I'm just showing you a few examples of papers. This is an example of one of the studies that was done. So this sort of multiple egg diagram here represents an exposure at a school in England, where essentially you've got the four circles A, B, C, and D. Within group A, these are classmates of a child with active infectious tuberculosis. B are closely associated but not in the same class. C are further away. And D are children that really didn't have much of a chance of being exposed to the index case. So you would expect that you would find a gradient here where the ones that are most exposed have the highest positivity followed by next highest positive, et cetera, et cetera. So what you see is that, for example, A, B, C, D, if you look at the ELISpot spot, 100% of children were positive on the ELISpot spot, then 53%, then 38%, and 17%. A very nice correlation. You have a similar correlation with the tuberculin skin test. So they're both kind of telling you, yeah, there was probably transmission here because the odds of this variation in positivity happening by chance is very unlikely. When the researchers actually looked at the results of these two gradients, one for the ELISpot, one for the TST, overall the response from the ELISpot correlated better with exposure than did the tuberculin skin test. And the tuberculin skin test was also found to be correlated with whether people had had prior BCG vaccination. So again, suggesting that while they both go in the right direction, the ELISpot may be more accurate. Although when you have an individual child in front of you who's TST positive, ELISpot negative, or vice versa, you can't tell which one is correct. Move on to another study. This study was just published about a month or so ago. This is a study looking at HIV-positive individuals. So this first chart is just showing the characteristics of the HIV-infected and HIV-uninfected population to show you that they tested a wide range of individuals, some with very low CD4 counts, some with higher CD4 counts, and then, of course, a bunch of patients that didn't have HIV to begin with. Go on to the next slide. In this figure, what they did is they actually did TB skin testing, and they used three different cutoffs, so 5, 10, and 15. So if you're HIV infected, your cutoff would be 5. If you're a close contact of an active case, your cutoff would be 5. If you're a regular, plain old person with a positive skin test, it would be 10. And if you follow the American guidelines, where somebody has no risk factors for TB, then their cutoff would be 15. They also did the T-spot TB test and the quantiferon gold test as well. And essentially what they showed is that if you look at the TST positivity between the HIV infected to those with a HIV infected with a CD4 count greater than 250 and final group CD4 count less than 250, you can see your positive TB skin test basically goes down in each one of these groups. Again, suggesting that it doesn't, it loses some of its sensitivity as your immune system gets weakened. The interferon gamma release assays, interestingly enough, really didn't seem to have the same decline. And the one that particularly stands out is the white bar there, which is the T-spot TB, didn't seem to change very much. The quantiferon test also did not change significantly between these groups. Move on to the next slide. Now, this is a really important slide, and what I've circled on this slide is essentially the kappa value. What the kappa value is it's a measurement of how much agreement there is between groups. So for example, perfect agreement would be a kappa score of 1, and complete disagreement would be a kappa score of 0. And essentially, when you're starting to get into the 0.6, 0.7, you've got pretty good agreement between these tests. What you see here is the reality that the Kappa scores are pretty bad between the various tests. So between the QuantiFERON and the T-SPOT, between the T-SPOT and the TST, between the TST and the QuantiFERON, the Kappa scores are pretty bad. And what that's telling you is you're getting very different information from these tests, and that there are a lot of discordant values where you're getting a positive on one and a negative on the other one. And as I've been speaking for the last half an hour, what you should be thinking about is how am I going to possibly figure out which one means what? So move to the next slide. So this is just to show you those red circles, showing you the amount of the number of cases which actually had discordant results. And so very confusing to know what to do with that. And again, as I've said 100 times already today, you can't prove which one's right. Go on to the next slide. This is a graph from a paper that was actually done here with our group, which basically looked at using T-SPOT TB testing in hemodialysis patients. And in a similar way to the previous studies, what we've done is we've looked at people who we think epidemiologically are very high risk for TB, and then people that have sort of weaker and weaker TB risk factors. And what you see on the left-hand side of the curve here, for example, patients who said, I previously had active tuberculosis, I was treated for active TB. If we asked a bunch of physicians if they thought this person was ever infected with TB in their life, we all answered yes, for example. The TB skin test was positive in about 20% of them, and the T-SPOT TB was positive in about 80% of them. So that right there, to me, suggests strongly that the TST in hemodialysis patients really isn't doing very much. It's not picking up people you would think should be positive. Then in the next curve over, we look at people who may have an abnormal chest film for active TB, specifically if they have upper lobe fibronodular disease, things like that. Again, the T-SPOT's positive in roughly 72-73%. The TST is positive in less than 20%. But again, physicians, if they see that abnormal chest film, they were quite good at saying that, you know, we think this person's infected with TB. In each one of these cases, though, you still can't tell which one's right. So even with the one on the far left, the previous history of TB, we didn't have lab confirmation in these people. Perhaps some of them got confused and said they had active TB, but in fact it was latent infection that actually happened a lot. You know, but in general, you can see by the linear trend lines on here, as your risk factors for TB infection went down, so did your positivity on your T-SPOT, and so did your sort of your positivity on the expert physician panel. Whereas the TB skin test essentially stayed the same; it really didn't change very much. Go on to the next slide. This is our table one from our paper where we looked at on the multivariate analysis on the right-hand side. You can see the T-SPOT TB really was correlated with stuff that makes sense on the multivariate analysis, whereas the tuberculin skin test, the only thing that came out positive as a risk factor for having a positive TB skin test was actually prior history of being vaccinated with BCG. So a study like this tells me that I think the T-SPOT's doing a better job of picking up tuberculosis, latent TB infection. However, it doesn't really help me that much with the individual patient in front of me where they've got one positive and one negative in terms of what to do with them. Move on to the next slide. So that's sort of figuring out what a positive or negative test means. But the other thing to think about is the fact that with the TB skin test, we have very good numbers from studies done years and years ago telling us what your risk of getting active TB is if you've got a positive skin test. So otherwise healthy person, positive TB skin test carries a 5 to 15% lifetime risk of getting active disease. Most of that risk, as I said in the beginning, is in the first 2 years after infection. However, we have no natural history studies with interferon gamma release assays. So having a positive QuantiFERON gold, I can't quote you a 5 to 15% lifetime risk of active disease. For all I know, maybe if it's more sensitive, maybe it's only a 2% risk over your lifetime, or maybe it's a 20% risk. We don't know. So that also makes it a challenge when you are using these tests and trying to explain to patients the risk benefits of taking preventative therapy, for example. Move on to the next slide. So I've said this several times now, when you get discordant results, so let's say a positive TB skin test or a negative interferon gamma release assay, Is that because of BCG, at which point you should believe the interferon gamma release assay, or is the interferon gamma release assay a false negative? Is how you're going to interpret this dependent upon how high risk you think the patient is? So what if this was a person with AIDS? What if they had a CD4 count of 100 and they have a positive TB skin test and a negative IGRA? Will you just ignore it, or will you say we should do something about the positive TST? The other side of things, what if you have a negative TST and a positive interferon gamma release assay? Is that because of the poor sensitivity of the tuberculin skin test, or is that because of a false positive IGRA? You can't tell. Move on to the next slide. So with all of this confusion, what essentially came out of the United States 2 years ago, which I think is now being re-looked at, was a recommendation that the QuantiFERON gold test could replace the TB skin test. So in other words, don't do both, just simply quit using your TB skin test, just use the QuantiFERON test. And the challenge with that is, as I've shown you in these studies, is there's so many of them that have discordant results, and it's very hard to just always assume that the reason it's discordant is because the TB skin test is wrong. Move on to the next slide. So we've looked at this a bit differently in Canada, and I think we've had the advantage of being able to look at the literature for a couple more years after the Americans came up with this particular recommendation. And we have not come up with the same recommendations in terms of us thinking about this. So for example, serial testing, where you've got healthcare workers and you're testing them year after year, there have been studies looking at this, and we're not sure what the results mean. In some patients, the interferon gamma release assay responses have increased. Some of them have decreased. Some of them have stayed the same. We're not sure how to interpret those data. Whereas the TB skin test, we've got 100 years of data telling us what it means. We can quote that 5 to 15% risk. We can quote the fact that your risk is highest in the first couple years after infection, etc. We can't quote any numbers like that with the interferon gamma release assays with accuracy. So in the end, in general, we're recommending continue to use a tuberculin skin test. Any testing with the interferon gamma release assay should be considered research. It's not something we would recommend adopting into general practice. What about screening of immigrants? Well, in general, in Canada, we don't recommend screening immigrants to begin with because most of them will not develop active TB, and we know that the follow-up with preventative therapy is usually not that great. You would only do it if they had underlying disease to put them at higher risk. So if they were diabetic, if they had an abnormal chest film, if they had a hematologic malignancy or end-stage renal failure, et cetera, then you would test them. So it's generally believed interferon gamma release assays aren't really going to improve efficiency enough to probably make it cost effective to screen this group. Therefore, we don't recommend them. If you're going to screen, continue to use the TST, again, because we know what the results mean, and we don't know what the results of the IGRAs necessarily mean. What about contact tracing? Well, in general, and this is one of the studies that I showed you where they had contacts in that British school, in general, the QuantiFERON and the T-SPOT tests seem to perform similarly to the TB skin test in non-BCG vaccinated, and definitely better in BCG vaccinated. There was a better correlation there. However, you continue to get considerable discordance with both tests. So let's say, let me give you a very real example. You have a 20-year-old person who's living with somebody with active pulmonary tuberculosis. They've been living with them for 2 months before the person was diagnosed. So 2 months exposure in the same home. TB skin test is 17 millimeters. T-SPOT TB test is negative. Are you just going to say, okay, fine, and we're going to ignore the fact that a positive TB skin test because it could be positive due to BCG, and we're just going to watch this person? Given that all of our literature tells you that when you've got a positive TST in that setting, you are at high risk for getting active disease, should you not do something? So if we go on to the next slide, what we've essentially recommended is that you don't just want to use interferon gamma release assays alone. We continue to favor the TST. If you want to use both and treat, if either one is positive, that's another option. And the only time where we said the IGRA might actually trump the TST is if you had a contact who really wasn't a contact. So that sometimes happens. You'll have somebody who was picked up in a public health net as saying they're a contact of an active case, but when you actually question them, it turns out, yes, they're related to that person, but they haven't visited during the time period that that person was actually infectious. So you might consider that person low risk. And then if you had a positive TST but a negative IGRA, in that setting, because they're low risk, you might feel comfortable saying, we're not going to do anything with this person, we're not going to treat them. Or on the next slide. What about immunocompromised? In general, and this is an area which I think is really evolving rapidly, there's almost a new paper coming out every week on this. In general, probably the IGRAs appear to be more sensitive than the TST, but just like the TST, as you get more immunocompromised, the interferon gamma release assays seem to have more sort of neither here nor there results, and that's presumably because you don't have enough T cells around to actually give a meaningful positive or negative result. So these tests seem to suffer from the same problem that the TST does, albeit perhaps slightly less than the TST. This needs to be further studied, so we're not there yet in terms of recommending throw the TST in the garbage. Go to the next slide. In terms of our recommendations, we have some people say you could recommend the interferon gamma release assay with the TST, and if either is positive, go ahead and treat. Others are saying there isn't enough evidence to recommend their use. Certainly, nobody seems to be saying they should be used without the tuberculin skin test at this stage. So go on to my summary slide here. At present, the role for interferon gamma release assays is relatively limited for a number of reasons that I've sort of touched on. The natural history of having a positive test is unknown. I don't know what happens to you when you're infected, what your likelihood is of getting active disease. Discordant results are very common between the interferon gamma release assays and tuberculin skin tests. Discordant results are not well defined. You can't figure out which one's correct. In general, we've said if you're using it, if you're going to use it with the tuberculin skin test, treat if either is positive in high-risk settings. And in low-risk settings, you may be willing to actually say, okay, we're going to believe one over the other because we don't think the person's infected in the first place. And as I mentioned in the beginning, truly a new study is out every week. And so this is a rapidly evolving field. But as I said, all the studies fundamentally suffer from the same challenges, which is you can't figure out which one is actually correct. So thank you very much for your time, and I hope that this was somewhat understandable. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Gardam. I don't know that I understood it, but the people who are listening to this teleclass are by far more intelligent than I, so I'm sure that they'll get a great deal out of it. It certainly is a complicated mess, isn't it? Is there any hope that we will ever have a thoroughly gold standard benchmark, completely accurate test for TB?
I think the challenge is always going to be the fact that most people who are infected never develop any symptoms. That's the first challenge. So you have to find some way of actually finding it in them, even if they don't have symptoms, and know that it's accurate, which is kind of what we've been getting at in this talk. And the second problem with TB is that it takes so long for people to develop disease that you really are looking at, you know, lots of patients and many years of follow-up. I think what these new assays really need are the kind of natural history studies we did decades and decades ago, which is essentially you find out people who are positive, who have had good exposure, so you have a reasonable sense when they were infected, and then they're followed clinically, and you see if they develop active tuberculosis or not. The challenge is that those studies were done with the tuberculin skin test before we had isoniazid. Doing those studies now when we have isoniazid is much more complicated from an ethical standpoint.
It's just layer upon layer of complication here, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
Between the clinicals and the ethicals and everything, it's quite a challenge. I'm glad you're looking into it. Listen, thank you very much for a really interesting and challenging lecture. I'm looking forward to hearing more on this topic in coming months and years. And, of course, we will look forward to hearing and seeing more of you in the national and international media in coming days, weeks, and years. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.